Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning there, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm stunning.
You know, I was reading in the Wall Street Journal.
Hold on. I'm stunning.
No, you're not. What do you want me to say? I'm sitting in the room with you, and that's a lie. But you got something?
No, that's.
Oh, okay, good. All right.
I'm stunning.
Yeah, Wall Street Journal. I was reading in, and it's a topic that I don't know. I think it's a topic that's very interesting. It was an article a while back by Katie McLaughlin called "The Next Big Flavor: Lavender Ice Cream, Shiso Soup, Trying to top Chipotle, the food industry is on a quest to find tastes that you didn't know you liked.
The next great taste idea.
And the article misses something, mm-hmm. I think. She starts talking about...
I think it misses a few things, but go ahead.
She says, you know, today the flavor Chipotle is ubiquitous. It's used in everything from Wise potato chips to chicken sandwiches served under the golden arches, along with dulce de leche and chai. It's one of a handful of tastes that have become mainstream in a country where not all that long ago salsa was considered edgy. And it talks about how 20 years ago, you know, a couple of chefs went down to Mexico, mm-hmm. and then have brought smoked
jalapeno back to the United States.
Smoked jalapeno is a...
Wow. Take it easy, man.
I'm sorry. I don't know why I got snooty. All of a sudden,
That from the guy who said dulce de leche.
That's true.
Okay, so back off.
All of a sudden, I'm Frasier. I don't know when that happened.
Oh, I know when it happened. I think it was 1981.
Okay.
You were having sherry in the college dorm.
I was. That's an actual memory, everyone. I was not wearing a smoking jacket or an ascot.
Let me tell you, when you got the radio show, the comparisons were just too great.
Yeah,
for me.
It's
really went over.
What does
the
that
top.
Make you?
Move
yeah,
to
I know,
Seattle.
I know I am, but what are you? Okay,
your dad.
Here's a difference about what's gone on. In the last several years, there have been the best chefs in the world and some okay chefs who have a lot of success, have broad market appeal. People like Hessen Blumenthal, who is a chef at a place called the Fat Duck, one of the best restaurants in Britain. Mm-hmm. Wiley DeFrenz here in New York is one of the most innovative chefs in America at his restaurant WD50, where we've eaten. Todd English of Olives,
Okay. If anybody's wondering what Francis thinks of Todd English's food, I think you now know. You are transparent.
But here's the deal, though. A lot of people like his food. He has a very broad appeal, and he's very valuable to flavor companies. Well, in the search for the last big thing, you know, you had someone who went to Mexico and brought food from the Mexican tradition into our realm.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now that was interesting, and those flavors were unfamiliar to us, but they were real food in someone else's tradition.
Correct.
What's going on now is you're finding that a lot of these top chefs are forming alliances and deals with International Flavors and Fragrances of New York, Firmenich USA, Firmenich Switzerland. These companies are commodifying flavor because what they're trying to do is catch the next thing that mm-hmm. the next big chef is going to do that eventually trickles down into mass market.
Well, I think what they're saying the next big thing is this whole chemistry of cooking that you heard us talking about before, and what are the components of that chemistry of cooking that are going to make it?
But here's
the
how
next
it's
thing.
But here's how it's changed. What happened before was that a chef would come up with a new combination, a new flavor, a new pepper, a new vegetable, mm-hmm. new to us from some other culture.
Right, they would import it from someplace else.
And the flavor companies worked like hell to develop the artificial flavor version of that, so they could put it on some garbage that they're going
to
sell
you to make you Fruity Pebbles.
And now what's changed is there are these chefs like Ferran Adrià, Wiley DeFrenz, who are putting food together in new ways. And here's an example. For the past year, Jeff Poppett, a marketing executive at Givaudan, which is a flavor firm. He'd been hunting for the right chefs around the world to sign deals that give the company access to their latest ideas. While reading about a restaurant in Girona, Spain called El Felar de Can Roca, a line startled him and drew his interest. The story said that the three chefs who are brothers were serving an extract of earth for dinner. He also heard that the pastry chef makes desserts that that imitate the aroma of the best-selling perfumes. You know, there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like food pornography. You know, food should taste like food.
Right. I'll tell you what I didn't like about Wiley DeFrenz's restaurant. Okay, now I think Wiley DeFrenz is one of the most intelligent people making food in this country, period. But at the same time, I felt like it was all a magic trick. Like, everything he was showing me was a magician showing me how to pull a quarter out of my ear. And while that was interesting to see one time, it's not the food that I want to eat.
And they're working on flavors like leather. It tastes mm-hmm. like the inside of a new car. On flavors that are not food.
Mm-hmm.
And why do we need to taste them? Right. I don't. It is to me, in a way.
Well, especially because smell is such an important component of taste. We are in effect tasting. When you sit in a new car, you're getting 90% of what you would get if you ate something like that when you smell the flavor of a new car.
But it would
that's
be
plenty.
But it would be but it would be rude to nosh on the leather seats, on the rich Corinthian leather seats.
I had a dog once that did that.
Yeah, and you had to take him to the vet. I think that there are real issues and real concerns about, and look, I want to go to El Bulli. I want to mm-hmm. go to Ferran Adrià's mm-hmm. place.
And I wanted to go to Wiley DeFrenz's place. I really did, and it was really interesting. But as far as making that my hometown restaurant, the restaurant that I'm going to go to every other week or once a month or even twice a year, I'm just not going to do that. I didn't enjoy the food enough, the taste of the food. It was all a science experiment.
And here's an example where we're talking about large food companies that are contracting with chefs to have the patent on their next big idea, to have the rights to their next big idea. It's now working back and forth. We've seen this a lot. David Burke is working with flavor sprays and working with chemical companies,
which we've already made fun of, so we don't need to
do
again.
Right, but you have chefs now using these corporate created foods.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it's interesting, and yes, it pushes the envelope, and yes, it's an experiment, but I don't know why it's necessary here. The partnership's working the other direction, too, particularly for chefs who like to experiment. Mr. DeFrenz, the chef at WD-50, says working with flavor companies gives him access to products like menthol crystals, which he dribbles over raw fish for what he calls a real cooling effect.
Do you know what my favorite cooling effect on fish, though, is, Francis?
What?
Cool.
Or menthol. Or mint. Here, it's resulted in dishes like the fat duck. They're talking about the same thing going on in the fat duck, his deal with Firmenich. It's resulted in dishes like strawberries with black olive puree mixed with leather flavor. What? Who cares?
Apparently some people do.
You know, and it's fun. I would like to go as sort of like, you know, if I had a sore
it's
in my mouth.
It's an experiment. It's like going to see the circus. I don't want to see the same circus
or different
once
circuses.
A month.
I don't always want to see the circus. Circuses.
Sorry, guys.
I don't know. I think that food, local food made by farmers, that's what I want to eat. And mm-hmm. food that has some relation to history and tradition. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be talking with Paul Hobbs, one of the most famous winemakers in the world, about some traditional wines that he makes. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1115. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. Our guest today is Paul Hobbs. Paul is one of the most famous winemakers in the world. Cantor Magazine just recently picked Cobos, his Argentine project, as the top Argentine wine, period. He makes wine in Argentina, Chile, California, and now also in Hungary. And we've known him since way back when. Welcome back to the show, Paul.
Thank you, Francis. Glad to be back.
Paul, how are you today?
Doing great.
Always nice to hear your voice, sir.
Yeah, now, good to hear yours.
Now, Paul, I happen to know a little bit about your background because, well, we've been drinking wine together for a long time. When you graduated from school, when you went to University of California, Davis, and you took your degree in enology?
That's right.
And what did you have a focus or a thesis when you did that?
Yes, I became particularly interested in oak aging, partly because that was sort of the new rage or the new pioneering work going on in California Mondavi, Hansel, and others were really very much just getting into the barrel aging program. They had been to France and looked around. So that seemed like a good area to do some exploratory work.
So this was like the late 70s, early 80s?
Yeah, actually, I wish I could say it was the late 70s and early 80s, but it was a little bit before that. It was mid-70s.
I was totally giving you the benefit of the doubt.
Thank you.
All right, so you're a top winemaker.
Just one second. A yes right there would have worked fine, and we could have moved right on. Man. We would have given you 7-8 years right back.
He still looks younger than we do. I'll tell you that. Okay, so you're an expert on oak, and you use oak in your wines, yes?
Indeed, yes,
now,
I do.
Now a lot of people don't understand oak, and we called you up because there were some articles, and I think there were oversimplified articles on oak that I want to talk about in a moment or two. But why don't you explain to people what oak does in wine? We hear people say wine is oaky, or it's not oaky, or it's too oaky, and there's a whole. What are people talking about, and what is the legitimate role that oak plays in wine?
Well, from my perspective as both a winemaker and a wine drinker, and oak is used only in certain wines, of course. Where the integration of or the use of oak complements wine, so not in all cases. In many Sauvignon Blancs or
Rieslings.
For example, Rieslings and wines like Gruners and so on. Oftentimes, oak would be inappropriate. It would be too dominant. The vanilla and toastiness that oak contributes would overwhelm the delicate terpene and floral flavors of some of those lighter style or more delicate wines. But in the cases of certain whites, like Chardonnay, for example, classic white Burgundies, and Bordeaux-style reds or Rhone wines, oak often is used as a flavoring agent to add more dimension and complexity to the wine and actually smooth the wine.
Let's talk about in layman's terms, what kind of flavors you can expect when you add oak to wine.
Yeah, well, essentially, I mean, the most common and best known, I think, is a simple vanilla character. And American oak has about 2.5 times the quantity of American oak, of vanilla versus French oak. So that's one of the key components. But there's also other phenolic. There's a lot of extractions that give a certain kind of sweetness to the wine, and actually react with the wine to kind of soften the tannin. Mm-hmm.
So basically, what we're talking about, when you put wine in an oak barrel, it, among other things, it pulls flavors from that oak and that get into the wine. That's what we're talking about.
Yes, and that's, of course, when the barrel is relatively new. After years of use, there's not much left to extract, but the barrel itself still has other advantages in terms of aging wines, particularly red wines.
Well, now, when we talk about the flavors being used, it's sort of like, does a winemaker, because you're a winemaker, does a winemaker view the flavors in an oak barrel like a chef would view spices, like they're appropriate for some foods but not others, as oak is appropriate for some wine and not others?
Yes, I think that's a good analogy, although oak is almost more like, in some cases, part of the meal in the sense that it might be almost like a dish, but it's integrated into the dish. So in other words, in some cases, depending on how it's used, it can be a major component right behind the fruit.
Well, a lot of people say now that wines from the New World are over-oaked or too oaky, and sometimes they're reduced to being just oak. Do you find that's the case in some wines?
Yes, I do. And I don't think it's limited to the New World only. I'm thinking...
it's kind of going around the world right now as we speak.
Yeah, I think, for example, if you look at... I mean, oak, for example, used in Aubryon's Sauvignon Blanc, their white wine, is 100% new oak, and it really tastes a lot of oak in the early years, but oak tends to fold in if you've got enough fruit. Over four or five years, the oak character will tend to diminish, and the fruit will come forward.
So as you're aging the wine, and now we're talking about aging a wine in a bottle, you have, let's say, a 1995 Aubryon Blanc. The oak in the early years, you're saying, is kind of on the outside and then begins to integrate as the wine ages?
That's exactly what happens, yes.
Well, you know, our guest is Paul Hobbs. He's one of the top winemakers in the world on 3 continents, and we're talking to him about the use of oak. Now, and we only have a half a minute left, but when we see that often the name of the forest where the oak came from is used by winemakers, I mean, do different oaks from different places impart different flavors into wine?
It really is incredible how different oaks harvested from different forests tend to be. Yes.
Wow.
The short answer is yes.
Wow. All right, well, we'll come back for the long answer after the break. Our guest is Paul Hobbs, Paul Hobbs Winery, Cobos in Argentina. He's working on another project in Chile and in Hungary as well. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Our guest is Paul Hobbs. Paul Hobbs is one of the top winemakers in the world. He's also an expert on the use of oak in wine, and that's sort of a... We're having kind of an egghead show today for all of you who have not tuned out yet. There's more eggheadness to come. People say... Now, we talked about using oak in wine, and oak is a flavor component of many wines. How is the flavor of oak imparted into wine?
Well, essentially, oak gives up what we simply call extractives. It's sort of like imparted like a tea bag, only... You can work with oak by placing chips or blocks of oak in wine and extracting flavor from it directly into the wine, or you can put wine into a vessel that is made of oak.
Like an oak barrel.
Like an oak barrel.
Is one method better than the other?
Not necessarily. I mean, the answer to that is yes and no. I mean, it depends on what your goal is. If you're making wines that are just more simple style wines where fruit and oak are kind of like, you know, right in your face, not necessarily totally sophisticated, but fun to drink, then I would not recommend working with a barrel.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause it's too expensive.
It's partly too expensive, and it may not even give you the results that you want. It may work against what you're after. But on a very, very high quality fruit, extremely high quality fruit, in my view, nothing can replace the barrel. Nothing has yet replaced the barrel.
Well, let me ask you about an oak barrel. What does the cost of an oak barrel, and what does the cost of an oak barrel add to the cost of a bottle of wine? People say wine is oak aged. Does that make the wine more expensive?
It can, yes. Usually, especially if it's oak aged in a barrel, then the costs go up a lot because, as I'm sure you know, the French oak barrel is somewhere between $600 and $700. A piece, and that will give you approximately 12 bottle cases of wine.
That's quite a per
so
bottle cost.
You're talking about almost $2 a bottle, right on the right to the winemaker.
Yes.
Before you start.
Yeah.
Well, you
correct.
Know, there are some people, and we're going to get back with this after the news. There are some people who have charged recently that, and this is a quote: "Oak barrels are obsolete." And I don't think you think that's the case. Am I right?
I really don't believe that's the case.
Great. Well, we're going to get Paul Hobbs all riled up after the news. Do come back and listen to us. We're going to talk about oak and wine and Paul's projects in Argentina and Chile, and we'll tell you where to find some of his great wines. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Paul Hobbs is one of the most sought-after winemakers in the world. He's also one of the most talented winemakers in the world. He makes the famous Paul Hobbs wines in California. He makes Cobos and Brumare and Nativo wines in Argentina. He makes wines in Chile, and now also he's making wines in Hungary, and he joins us today, and our topic today is oak. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you very much, Francis.
Now we were talking before the break about oak barrels, because that's a term that we hear a lot when we're talking about wine. The wine is oaky or the wine's not oaky. There are different ways to impart oak flavoring into wine. You can put in oak chips or oak staves or tea bags with oak shavings in them. You can chop up your furniture and then drop that into the barrel. Or you can age wine in very expensive hand-coopered oak barrels.
Which, as Paul Hobbs just told us, can add $2 to a bottle from the winemaker's level.
But I was reading the San Francisco Mail and Guardian.
Why were you reading the San Francisco Mail and Guardian?
Because I'm an idiot. I read everything about wine. And here he says, the San Francisco Mail and Guardian says, oak barrels are obsolete, according to United States vintners, who say, that's all of them, you're in there, Paul, I guess, who say aging wine in metal tanks with pieces of oak thrown in costs less and tastes just as good. And here's a quote from Jeff Runquist, winemaker of McManus Family Vineyards in Northern California, very famous, that was a different McManus, he says, the proof is in the pudding. Put the wine in your mouth and tell me whether the oak taste you come up with is from barrel or from chips. I'll be damned if anyone could walk in here and tell the difference. Paul, is Jeff Runquist actually damned at this point?
Or does he just have a damned. Really or yeah, does he have a really good lock on his door?
I think it's pretty easy to tell the difference.
Yeah, so Jeff Runquist is damned.
I think so.
Oh, damn. So
that's tough for him, but...
So, all right, yeah, when I read that, I thought it was one of the dumbest things I'd ever read, so I thought I would call you to verify that. Now, what is the difference on the palate? What can you taste that's worth... I mean, to put chips into your wine costs about $1.10 for 25 cases. To put it in an oak barrel costs $650 for 25 cases. What are you, crazy? Why are you spending $650? What does that do to your finest wines? Why do your finest wines have to be aged in oak
barrels? I can save you $648.90 a barrel.
Yeah.
We just love to beat our heads against the wall and lose money.
So
the thing is, adding chips and, well, oak products that are not barrels, let's say, come in a variety of forms, as you know. Liquid extract that you simply just pour into the wine and flavor it that way.
It's called liquid smoke, and it is one of the most disgusting ways to flavor wine on the planet.
Yeah, that's the bottom of the totem pole.
Yeah.
And
it reminds me, to interrupt you again, because that's what we're good at, it reminds me of being at this coffee shop when you want a hazelnut coffee and they reach for the Tirani syrups. And I like the Tirani syrups in my coffee, but not in my wine. Anyway.
Yeah. So that's how it works. And then you can add chips, which are actually very much like you would get from a chipper, very small. And then there's something called segments, which are about the size of dominoes.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's even a product called interstave or inner stave, and that is those are staves that are put into the vat where the wine is aged. But in all those cases, in every one of those cases, the other aspects of what happens in a barrel cannot be duplicated.
So what else happens?
I think that's a really important issue for us to tell everybody that oak aging is not just the oak flavor.
Yeah, and that is the key. I mean, there's efforts to try to mimic what goes on in a barrel, but it's an extremely complex thing because part of what happens is the inner barrel surface, there's an exchange with the atmosphere. There's some evaporative loss of the wine. The surface is rough, and it allows for natural clarification of the wine and stabilization of the wine.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's a very, very slow process. And that's part of what develops the character and quality of wine. And also, the quality of that interaction is so difficult to manufacture, artificial.
And just so everybody knows exactly, we're talking here with Paul Hobbs today, one of the preeminent winemakers in the world, who also happened to do his graduate degree in oak aging. Is that correct, Paul?
That's correct, yes. Oak extracts.
Now, what is different in the wine? Why do I care as a consumer? Because I'm like, I don't care what your trouble is as the winemaker, but why do I care as a consumer? I have two glasses in front of me. One is made in an old oak barrel where they threw in a bunch of wood chips, and the other one is made in an oak barrel that imparts some flavor. What's the difference between the two on the glass?
And it's just a difference in sophistication of product. It's a much more rustic and straightforward. I mean, it's sort of like there's no sophistication to any high level. I mean, I don't know of many wines that I mean, I read a piece that said that some wines aged with chips and so on cost as much as $100 a bottle, and that may happen from time to time, because something that people are doing is taking wood staves. Some of them are, one product is called Zigzags, for example, and then putting them in barrels that have been used for a couple of years to impart wood flavor, and that does help approximate, but there's nothing quite the same as a new barrel with top quality wine, and I can't even tell you exactly why it works that way. We just know that it does. And I do a lot of work with oak products as well, not in Paul Hobbs wines, but for clients that I have. And those work perfectly for wines, I think, that are at least under $15 a bottle, but the tannins are not nearly as well integrated. They're usually dustier and coarser, and you can taste the difference.
You're talking about a less expensive, lower quality wine. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's basically what you're talking about.
It's a much more basic product. It's sort of like a difference between maybe a Ferrari and a Fiat.
Well, the McManus Family Vineyards, maker of Fiats in Northern California, the town of Ripon, who has the quote, "Put the wine in your mouth and tell me whether the oak you can taste came from a barrel or chips. I'll be damned if anyone could walk in here and taste the difference. We're going to send sympathy cards to his family. He has been. He's been damned. It's damned. All right. Next topic we want to talk to you about is there have also been articles in Decanter Magazine wrote an article about filtering wine. Now, we see in a lot of American wines, a lot of the hot, trendy ones, says unfined and unfiltered. Now, let me explain to people that wine can actually be filtered like through a coffee filter or through other types of filters. And fining of wine is where we clarify the wine, like you would clarify a soup to make it a consomme, a stock to make it a consomme, by running some sort of protein or some other material that makes it very clear and crystal.
And makes other things attached to it. As it runs through the wine, other things, the impurities will attach to it.
A lot of winemakers like to make wines unfined and unfiltered. Paul, why do they do that?
Why do winemakers like to make wine unfined and unfiltered?
Yeah, why would someone be tempted to do that when you can just run it through a filter and then fine it and you'll know it's stable and perfect?
Yeah, basically, what we found, and that we've done a lot of work in this area, what we find in most cases where fining and or filtration is used, some flavor and some richness or something is taken more than just clarifying. The fining and filtration agents are typically not 100% specific for what it is that you want to get. So you're going to get some other good stuff as well as some of the bad stuff.
You take out some of the bad, you take out some of the good.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of a compromise or trade-off in the process.
In the article in Decanter by Panos Kakaviatos, I probably pronounced that wrong, he wrote that leaving wine unfiltered is the equivalent of landing a plane without help from the control tower. What do you say about that?
Paul owns his own airport.
So, in some cases, I would agree with that. I mean, if you're making a sweet wine, and the delicacy of that wine, and plus the residual sugar, could cause a re-fermentation in the bottle, I would go with that statement. On the other hand, if you're making a red wine that's through both primary and secondary fermentations, and it's extremely been handled in a very healthy way, I think that statement bears no weight whatsoever.
Well, and we also have a quote later on where he says, "Great wines have nothing to gain from the absence of fining and filtration."
I think we have that quote right now.
Yeah.
Are these the quotes from Denis de Bordeaux?
They are from Denis de Bordeaux, yeah, the Bordeaux wine consultant, Denis de Bordeaux.
Yeah, he's a sharp fellow.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't sound like a compliment, Paul.
Yeah, well, actually he is, and I'm not sure why he would make such a blanket style statement, so maybe he was talking about specific kinds of wines, because certain, particularly sweet wines, again, and or really very delicate, you know, for example, we were talking earlier about wines where barrel wouldn't be appropriate.
Actually, Paul, we're going to come back in just a moment, and we're going to talk about that, and we're also going to talk about your new project in Hungary and where people can pick up some of your wines. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is the inimitable Paul Hobbs of Paul Hobbs Winery in California, Argentina, Chile, and Hungary now. I'm sorry, I cut you off before the break, Paul. We were talking about how, to sort of close the issue, we were saying that, you know, when you see unfined and unfiltered wines on the label, when you see those words on the label of a wine, the winemaker has made a choice to do something that maybe is a little bit more dangerous, but to work very hard to keep things very clean, to leave as much as possible of the natural wine in there. Is that a fair characterization?
I think so, yeah. Yes.
And I think that if you're a sloppy winemaker, and I'm not saying that all fine and filtered wines are sloppy, but if you've made some mistakes or you're not quite sure of where things are going, you can get an extra measure of safety from fining and filtering your wines. I mean,
yes, that's exactly right. I think in some cases where fining and unfined and or unfiltered is used, maybe as a marketing tool, because some of the press has said, hey, that's the way to go, and so people put that on there when they probably should have fined it or filtered it.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the best wines in the world are made with no fining whatsoever or filtration.
We definitely find though sometimes that wines that are made in that way can be sloppy. We've seen some wines that are unfined and unfiltered, and you know what? Maybe you should have fined and filtered this wine.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the other thing is there are some no sulfites wines out there that we see out here, and
mm-hmm.
They're just crazy. I mean, sulfites are natural. Sulfites are mined sulfur is an organic substance, and used in moderation, it's very stabilizing on wine.
Mm-hmm.
And very often when you see wines that are billed as no sulfite organic wine, they just turn on the shelf.
They do.
You know?
The sulfites are actually, I think you know that yeast produce them in bread fermentation. It's a fermentation product. And it's so they're produced naturally during the fermentation product at low levels. So all wines, probably all breads, cheeses, and so on, contain some natural low level of sulfites. And they're, of course, the winemaker uses them, and they're very natural,
mm-hmm.
very natural product to basically prevent the wine from oxidation and losing its fruit.
And while we're talking about sulfites, just a detail that I want to put in there. If you go to a salad bar at any of the chain restaurants or anywhere that you would see a salad bar out, generally there's more sulfites on your spinach than there is in any bottle of wine that you would buy.
I would agree.
Also, yeah. There's another thing that I want to point out. A lot of people have problems with allergies and they're allergic to wines. If you're more allergic to whites than reds, then perhaps you do have a problem with sulfites because there's more sulfur in the whites than there are in the reds. But a lot of people that have allergies with wines are more allergic to reds, and that's generally due to the histamines in the red wine.
So it's not sulfites after all.
Right.
Okay, enough with the dork fest. Paul, what's going on in what's going on in Hungary? What are you doing in Hungary, man?
Well, I'm headed there on Tuesday, and we're actually, friends, I'm really glad you asked the question. We're doing some really very neat, groundbreaking stuff, because as we talked before, one of the problems Hungary has been under communist rule for a long time.
Does that affect the winemaking?
It sure did. It basically affected everything, affected the mentality of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sort of like dumbed down everything, and a lot that was what they were doing, the great traditional wines that they were making, some of that has been lost, some of the great vineyards have been lost, so on and so forth. But what we're doing now is bringing back some of these terrific and very classic traditional style wines. We're also adding a twist to that, and we're doing some new products. And one of the things I'm working on specifically is making dry ferment. that is absolutely delicious, very refreshing.
And Firmament is a grape type.
It is a grape type, yes. It's the most important grape varietal used in the making of the famed Tokai wines, the Azu wines.
Mm-hmm. And Tokai, just for those of you, in New Brunswick, actually, we have a very large Hungarian population, so you may recall that... You may know that Tokaj is a region, and its famous dessert wines of Hungary were known as Tokaj Azu, which, prior to World War II, Tokaj Azu and Chateau Yquem were universally considered to be the two great dessert wines of the world, and then after World War II and Hungarian rule came in, the Tokaj Azu lost its stature but never its place in Hungarian culture. Now, the Tokaj Azu was the first wine to come back in Hungary, but now people are working on, you can't drink sweet wine all the time, people are working on the dry wines made from that same great grape ferment, and that's what you're doing now. Are you doing it in the region of Tokaj?
In the region, yes.
Wow.
Have you been able to find any older vineyards in the area?
There are, and we're finding some great old plantings. Not everything was taken out, not everything was removed, but a lot was for higher volume varieties. Because basically, what the communist regime under communist rule, what they wanted was production.
Right, the most that they could possibly produce.
We saw some of that in Argentina as well in the '70s in Argentina. A lot of the great Malbec vineyards were pulled out and replaced with Criollo that would produce up to 5, 6, 7 times more tonnage just so they could get the alcohol.
Wow, that's really terrible.
Mind-boggling.
Well, I think what you're seeing in Hungary and why I think to me right now it's the most exciting region of the world to watch, no joke, because the wines aren't, it's not quite there yet. There's not a, but there are some exciting wines.
It's not quite there again.
Right, it's not there again.
It was there for hundreds of years.
Because you're seeing the rebirth of one of the great European wine regions that basically went to sleep for 50 or 60 years and now is returning. And when you have people like Paul Hobbs and the owners of Vega Sicilia, which is the biggest Spanish wine producer, going in there, you're going to see that's going to be a very important region 15 years from now, and you can learn about it now. Hey, listen, we'll be back in just a moment. Our guest is Paul Hobbs, one of the top winemakers in the world. We'll be talking more with him about Hungarian wine in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Francis and Mark of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Paul Hobbs. Paul Hobbs has established himself as one of the best winemakers in California. His Cobos wines from Argentina have been ranked the best wine in Argentina. We have three vintages of them in our cellar at the restaurant and, well, in my cellar at home. If you come over, it's at the bottom, though, so I don't open that very often. And also in Chile, and now we're talking about his projects in Hungary. Now, when you talk about I have to tell you, the thing that I said before the news was that Hungary is an exciting place to watch because we know it has a history as being one of as the greatest wine country in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then Eastern European wine across the board fell off the map right after World War II.
Well, Tokaj Azu was wine of kings. I mean, that's what it was known as.
And the wines of Somló were supposed to make you smarter. The Austro-Hungarian emperors really supported the wine industry. What is it like to be in, and I know you were sort of on the ground floor in Argentina, but what's it like to be in post-communist Hungary where there's a tradition that maybe wasn't in Argentina that goes back hundreds of years, and here you are trying to resurrect it where maybe even some of the locals don't know what was in the history? How much is looking back and how much is looking forward?
Yeah, that's a very, I'm just sort of blown away because there's a lot of tradition there. And yet, it's now in the hands of, the great-grandchildren or grandchildren. And for a period of time, maybe they saw their father or their family in the business, and then they had to step out of the business. Now they're coming back into it again. So maybe they were out for 15, 20, 30 years.
Hmm.
And some of them are, some of the great winemakers are just, they're getting back into it again.
Are you seeing people go back into it?
Yes. Not many, but there's a handful, like Istvan Shepchi, and he's probably today the greatest Hungarian Tokaj maker.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really, when I think about what's going on, I mean, I think of him and what he went through. And this is something that he told me. It happened to him, and it also happened to several of his friends and his father's friends.
Amazing. Hey, Paul, we got to run. Hour's up.
It's been great. Congratulations on winning Decanter Magazine number one wine in South America.
For Cobos.
For Cobos.
Thank you very much, Mark. Francis, great to talk to you.
Super. Take care. That was Paul Hobbs, one of the best winemakers in the world. Do you want to find out more about Hungarian wines? And you want to find out more about Paul Hobbs and our restaurants? You can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Servus. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Costa.
We are the Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.